Well, can you hear me anyway?
Yes.
Sorry, it doesn't seem, I mean, it's, all the lights are blinking appropriately, but it doesn't seem to be on. So, we've got, as they might say, an embarrassment of riches for the lessons this week. And many of them are going to be bypassed rather hurriedly to get to one of the thornier sections in the gospel, namely that last passage of the gospel we heard, where it seems, at a straightforward reading, that Jesus is acting rather uncharacteristically harsh and insulting and insensitively and bigotedly and with prejudice, and calling a forlorn outcast woman a dog. And it's kind of the magnetic center of the gospel today, and so we're going to have to deal with it. But just in passing, to note some of the things that we're walking by. And first of all is this story from the Old Testament. It's we've been hearing the cycle of the Joseph stories, and we heard how his brothers, again, a mixed family from many different mothers, sold him into slavery, and how many years later they appear before him without knowing who it is. And it is a remarkable ancient story of forgiveness that in so many ways anticipates both the life and the teaching and the demonstration of Jesus himself. And I don't know if it has parallel in the ancient world, but it's a remarkable foreshadowing not only of the practice of forgiveness and how surprising it is when every reason would have been given for vengeance, for revenge, for bitterness. And yet Joseph does not succumb to that and becomes a figure of great compassion. And then also the way God is at work in the events of our human lives, bringing about things which we might not expect. And so there are both things in that, and I want to draw attention to them as I pass by. Sure, like a train traveling through Europe. Oh, there's Shark. You know. And then the first part of the gospel, what I hope for us is that we hear in that something more than just a very obscure, sort of arcane dietary regulation of 2,000 years ago. It's not what comes into the mouth that defiles a person, but it is the intention of the heart that defiles a person. And I think the principle that really Jesus is invoking here is that it's not the world around you that causes trouble for your heart. It's not what you see. It's how you see it. And I would say some of the contemporary ways where this shows up, I mean, we've been talking a little bit here about the furor in town over the novel Punxsutawney. And I would suggest that really lingering around an issue like this of censorship or of withholding a book from readers, it's not just a developmental issue, are they old enough, but it's a moral issue, and it's an issue of defilement. I don't want my children looking at these things and taking that kind of gritty depiction of a street kid. I don't want them taking that in because I feel like it's going to get inside them or distort them. And Jesus is really saying, actually, our freedom is greater than we suppose. We can look on the world as it is and not feel like it is going to defile us. It is not what you see, it's how you see it. So, another cathedral zooming by. Now we get to the story of the Canaanite woman. And there is a lot going on in this story. And it's funny. The people, namely people like me, people who have to stand up and try to interpret this, people are twisted into knots at how apparently harsh and cruel and insensitive Jesus really is. And what I have come to is that the Jesus I know from the Gospels, the broad picture of Jesus, is one of tenderness and compassion, He can be challenging and harsh, as he was just being so with the Pharisees, namely those in power. But to those who are outcast, who are oppressed, who are marginalized, Jesus has a great, great heart. And so when we hear this going on, are we to suppose that Jesus, just on a bad day, became a kind of belligerent Palestinian peasant full of prejudice and was just sort of full of this attitude, you know, you Canaanite woman, you dog? Is that what we're to suppose? And I don't think so. I'm going to say that I hear this exchange between Jesus, and although I don't know exactly what was happening, I know that what seems to be happening was not. Jesus was not calling this woman a dog. So what was going on? What was going on? And it's both an event. I mean, Mark tells the story too, although in Mark, she's not named a Canaanite woman. She's named a Syrophoenician woman, which would have been the contemporary term. It's an event in the life of Jesus. It is also profoundly a gospel literary event. Matthew is being very literary here with the way he's telling this story. And one of the first clues is he calls the woman a Canaanite. And that word appears exactly once in the entire New Testament. And it's right here. And what that does is it begins to invoke some of the foundational stories in the history of Israel and the way Israel really understood itself, the conquest of Canaan. God has given you these lands, and you are to go in. And I'll actually read a little bit of the relevant passage from Deuteronomy. It's kind of scary. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are about to enter and occupy, and he clears away the many nations before you, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, although this whole area was known broadly as Canaan, the Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, seven nations mightier and more numerous than you, and when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must utterly destroy them. Make no covenant with them and show them no mercy. Show them no mercy. Utterly destroy them, show them no mercy. Okay, this is what begins to be invoked when Matthew calls her a Canaanite woman. All of that. And as the story develops, you can also tell that something more than obviously is going on here, because she starts shouting, Jesus doesn't answer. Is that just because he's suddenly hard-hearted? Again, I don't think so. I think Jesus is aware of a situation to a far greater degree than any of the people that were around him. And his disciples come and use exactly the same phrase that they used with the feeding of the 5,000. The people were there and they come to Jesus and say, send them away. And Jesus says, no, you give them something to eat. Well, here, she's shouting after us, send her away. It's exactly the same word. And so the disciples, as they are through this entire set of passages, they're being used as a kind of foil. They don't get it. They didn't get it about the parable of what defiles. We're soon to hear them. I mean, it's comic the way they don't get it. Jesus says, beware the yeast of the Pharisees. And the disciples go, it's because we haven't brought any bread. And Jesus goes, no, it's a metaphor, you guys. And so what is being told in this encounter, he doesn't say anything. The disciples say, send her away. She comes and kneels before him. He says, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Don't know exactly what he means by that. I've been hearing that as a rhetorical question. Is that what you think? I've been sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel? I think Jesus is in a storm or a field of prejudice and bigotry and ancient, ancient enmities, and he's playing with it. It's like almost like a matador, sort of doing things to raise prejudice up, and the, you know, they charge, and he moves around gracefully. And then the crux. Lord, help me. It's not fair to take the children's food and throw them to the dogs. Again, you can choose to believe that Jesus was being really rather remarkably cruel, or you can imagine that he's looking that woman in the eye. And it's almost the same way that, like, people of color can trade racial epithets with each other in a way that a white person could never do. They're having this internal conversation, and I think they're connected. Or Jesus is talking sort of like a comedian might talk, who often would say things exactly the opposite of what he or she truly believes, but would say it with emphasis and exaggeration to lift it up. To lift it up. So he calls her a dog, but I think the bond is really quite intimate between them. And what is really occurring in the breadth of this story is that Jesus is asking his hearers, and Matthew is asking the whole community, to reconsider what had been one of their founding stories. The story of the conquest of Canaan, its utter destruction, the mercilessness with which they were supposed to relate to them, that's being overturned. There is a new story that's coming in, and this woman, because she's called a Canaanite, she stands for that new story. And again, it's in the Greek, Kyrie eleison, Kyrie eleison, Lord have mercy, which again, to our ears, it's a scholarly note. To their ears, they would have heard, you know, they would have known, show them no mercy, and now this Canaanite woman is before Jesus, Lord have mercy. And Jesus is talking with her and connected to her and loves the fact that she lives in a marginal place, and yet she has not internalized her own marginal status. She's not filled with bitterness. She's not filled with hatred. In fact, she's fairly playful, and she is very earnest in trying to get what she wants. And Jesus has seen this, I believe, all along. The question for us, I think, is, I think we too have lots of stories, stories in church, stories in Western culture, that need to be reevaluated. We need to look at some of the stories we tell. I mean, one of the obvious parallels would be for us, you could substitute for the Jebusites and the Perizzites and the Hittites. You could substitute the Iroquois and the Chippewa and the Sioux and the Blackfeet, and understand that we too, as a nation, have a story of conquest, and that we have not adequately looked at that and understood a new way of seeing our relationship to the native peoples whose land we took. Another story that might that is in the process of being revised. It's both a cosmological story, and it's the story of our relationship to the natural world. Again, it's like a paradigm. We in the West have lived with a relationship to the natural world for centuries that regarded the natural world as a kind of a dead place, or a place merely for our use. And the Christian story and the images in Genesis with dominion and such, they bear a part in that. But as I so often joke, the biblical world has a God who is so near the earth that he looks down and the people look like grasshoppers to him. And this is not the cosmos we inhabit. This is not the cosmos of 10 billion light years and of a sense of our place in a creation that is ongoing. And there are many people saying we need to to tell ourselves a new story about our place in the universe. The old story doesn't really situate us with clarity and power. And a relationship with the natural world that is not adversarial and not not the mind of the plunderer, but of a collaborator and a participant. This would get more into the realm of, say, psychotherapy. But I'm sure many of us would understand that our own lives are often guided by the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. And part of what psychotherapy is about is learning actually to hear those stories, having them lifted out. I mean, it's so many of the things and we tell ourselves, the internal dialogues that go on more or less incessantly, we don't even notice them anymore. And so psychotherapy would be to lift those stories up so that we can actually hear them and say, is that the story that really is the truth of my life? Or is that a story that I learned about myself when I was a child and my parents were afraid? Or did I learn it at school? Or how did I learn that story about myself? And do I need to keep telling that story? And of course, this is all the practice of repentance, which is, again, not feeling bad, but seeing things new, seeing things fresh, seeing the stories that guide our culture, seeing the stories that guide our individual lives with fresh eyes, and to see if they actually are in need of some kind of revision. And I think Jesus would give to us and grant to us the heart space and the heart freedom to say, that story no longer conveys a deep truth, if ever it did. But the story now needs to change. And so, that can be threatening. I think it was threatening to the Pharisees. But remember, whenever we hear something that suggests from the Gospels that we need to change, that we need to see things in a different way, a more comprehensive way, it's good news for us. It takes us out of a narrow and cramped perspective and gives us an open, generous perspective. And believe it or not, that's what I think was going on between Jesus and this feisty woman of Canaan.